This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and develop your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk with the producer and director of a film about the ways aviation has transformed the world. In the news, we look at relationships between Middle Eastern and U.S. airlines, the outlook for business aircraft sales, Chinese radar advancements, and a report of health problems with new crew uniforms. We also have for you a compelling story sent to us by a Marine. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 427 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me is first Rob Mark. He's senior editor at Flying Magazine, a flight instructor, and he publishes the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Well, good evening to everybody from the window where I just saw the super moon, and it was super.
It was super, huh?
Yeah, super.
Well, we're overcast, so we didn't get to see it here in Connecticut. Also with us is Brian Coleman, our associate producer. Have you seen the moon? Oh, maybe it's too early for you to see the moon out there.
No, I saw the moon last night. So, yeah, it was big and pretty. And, well, I should probably save this for the other segment, but I listened to the show 2 weeks ago, the Halloween show, and boy, were my jokes bad that I told on that show. Remind me never to do that ever again.
All right. Sheesh. All right. Also joining us is Max Trescott, the other Max. He's a CFI and author and a glass cockpit expert. Hey, Max.
I'm sorry. I'm sitting here snorting, listening to Brian. It was so funny. I mean, I thought his jokes were cute. So I don't know what that says. But anyway, Brian, you can tell your jokes anytime. So.
Glad someone liked them.
But then again, you have to put this in perspective. I'm up here by San Francisco, and I've spent most of the day in the fog. It was one of those kinds of days. So all my flights canceled, and it's that time of year again, folks.
David Vanderhoof was scheduled to join us. We've been having some Skype difficulties, and we couldn't bring him into the call. Maybe that'll change as we go through the program here. Hopefully it will. But otherwise, we'll have to go without David this episode. But we do have a guest. Our guest this episode is Brian Terwilliger. Brian's a licensed pilot and a filmmaker. He produced and directed the 2005 aviation film 1/6 Right. I think most of us are familiar with that film. Well, now Brian's produced and directed a National Geographic film titled Living in the Age of Airplanes. It's narrated by Harrison Ford, and it also features an original score by the late Academy Award-winning composer James Horner. Think Avatar and Titanic. Now, Living in the Age of Airplanes looks at the, kind of dramatic ways aviation has transformed the world. It's filmed in 18 countries and across all 7 continents. So, Brian, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Well, thank you so much. Great to be here.
Now, do you produce aviation-related films exclusively, or do you do other work?
Well, so far, yeah, everything I've done has been aviation-related. Yep.
Fantastic. We love it. We love it. All right. Well, we're going to talk about Living in the Age of Airplanes coming up. First, we have some aviation news we want to talk about. So with that, I'll ask, is everyone ready?
Can I ask, why do we ask if everybody's ready?
I don't know. It's just something I do.
Okay.
Are you tired of it? We can stop doing it.
Well, when are we ever not ready? I mean, come on.
All right, here we go. Our first story comes from Investopedia.com. This is Qatar Airways hopes to strengthen relationship with American Airlines. CAPA, the Center for Aviation, awarded Qatar Airways their Airline of the Year award. In a subsequent interview with Qatar CEO Akbar Al Baker, he talked about wanting to strengthen the airline's strategic partnership with American Airlines. Now, American now partners with both Qatar Airways and Etihad Airways, but Al Baker wants American to drop its partnership with Etihad and work only with Qatar. This is kind of an interesting relationship always, because we also have the contention between a certain airline coalition, the Partnership for Open and Fair Skies, and some of the Middle Eastern airlines. In fact, the Partnership for Open and Fair Skies has just issued a statement concerning the open and fair skies on the election of Donald Trump. And not that we want to get too deep into politics, because that always gets us in trouble. But the quote is, "We look forward to briefing President-elect Donald Trump and his new administration on the massive unfair subsidies that the UAE and Qatar give to their state-owned Gulf carriers. The Gulf carrier subsidies threaten the jobs of 300,000 U.S. aviation workers and the American aviation industry as a whole. And we are optimistic that the Trump administration will stand up to the UAE and Qatar, enforce our trade agreements, and fight for American jobs." So this is kind of the ongoing battle between some of the U.S. airlines and the Middle East. It's over this issue of subsidies. And I always get kind of wound up in definitions of what subsidies are. And I think maybe there's different perspectives on this, but I don't know. What do you guys think? Is this something new, or is this the same old spat between the parties?
I think it depends on what kind of glasses you're looking for or looking through when you talk about cash flow. You know, some people call it subsidies. Some call them investment investment capital. There's a whole bunch of different names for it, depending on where you are. But I just wanted to correct one minor thing that you mentioned about, you know, since we were mentioning our president-elect, that we get in trouble when we talk politics. Not really. That's not true. I usually get us in trouble when I talk politics.
No,
so
that's
I have
true.
To take heed for that. Okay. No, I just wanted
true.
To make that clear.
Okay.
Now, I just found the two stories really fascinating, and I just wonder what the folks over at American are doing right now. They must be spinning, because on the one hand, I think they'd probably prefer to have an exclusive partnership. On the other hand, I think they would love for the Middle East carriers just to go away and not have to deal with them as competitors. So I don't know. I'm really looking forward to seeing how this one's going to play out.
We've seen this before, you know, with these parties. And I think everybody involved is doing what they're supposed to do to protect the interests of their own organization, their own company or whatever. But I don't see any path here to any kind of a meaningful resolution. Now, you know, maybe with the new administration, maybe there'd be a different approach, but as of right now, I just don't see it. Well, let's talk a little bit closer to home here. GAMA, the General Aviation Manufacturers Association, released a report that says that the third quarter 2016 business jet and airplane shipments worldwide were 534 units, and that's down from 542 a year ago. Billings were $4.1 billion versus $5.3 billion for the quarter in 2015. Rob, you probably follow business aviation maybe more closely than the rest of us. The outlook here is business aviation doesn't seem to be recovering as smartly as some of the other aviation sectors.
Well, that's absolutely true, and it has never come back up since the days when the automakers flew their airplanes to Washington to ask for handouts during the economy issue, and purchasers started canceling left and right, and then the economy tanked, and they've sold quite a few airplanes since then. But each quarter, except this time, of course, Cessna, beat the odds and sold more airplanes. But of course, it's not just about the numbers of airframes. You have to look at the total dollar value. And while the number of airframes is up, the total dollar value is up, but not by that much, which kind of tells us that maybe those are the smaller airplanes that are selling. At least that's what it kind of looks like on the surface. So, yeah, we're not out of the woods yet at all.
Yeah, AvWeb talked to Richard Abalafia from the Teal Group, and Richard believes that the situation is not going to be much better. In fact, I think he says that he doesn't see any real uptick through 2020. Richard, he's always got a great quote. He's always got a something that's notable. Richard says, no one wants to use the phrase the new normal, but it sure looks like the new normal to me. He says, it looks as if the recovery doesn't seem to be gaining momentum. We've actually lost a little ground over the past couple of years. I don't know if there's something magic that the business aviation sector can produce that's going to change things, turn them around. I guess the argument is, you know, is it based on economic conditions or are there other issues associated with buying business aircraft that's kind of keeping this market from growing?
Well, I think that's a really good question. And I don't know that any Richard's probably the better one to ask that of. But my guess is that it's still uncertainty. We've been listening to people being uncertain. They were uncertain before the 2008 election. They were uncertain before this election. And the one good thing that did happen is that after the results were in last week, the stock market kind of went through the roof. And while that is not an indicator of complete and utter positive business success, it's a move in the right direction. But I think it's going to take a little more another good year to see what's going to happen with this new administration.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but I still think that if, for example, corporate taxes were to be lowered and they could repatriate an awful lot of money at, let's say a 10% tax rate, that gives corporate America a ton of money to go out and buy new aircraft. So I see that potentially as a good thing.
Yeah, that's a good point. And now, of course, will that actually happen? If it does,
sure.
Hey, listen, you know, I mean, they're also looking forward to saying that if we did bring that cash back into the U.S., 10% of I forgot how many hundreds of billions of dollars they're thinking is stashed under mattresses in various parts of the world. But that would go a long way toward some of the infrastructure issues that we have in the U.S. as well. Mm-hmm.
Maybe we can ask our guest, Brian Terwilliger. Brian, maybe even more broadly, in your travels and experiences putting together these films, do you have a sense for sort of what the mood is, what people think the outlook might be for aviation? Is it positive? Is it exciting? Or is it kind of just, well, we're sort of muddling along? Do you get a sense for that sort of thing?
Well, it's, you know, hard to say. You know, the movie, we actually shot it a few years ago in terms of the filming aspect of it. Took a long time for post-production. Then it was in IMAX theaters for 18 months up until a couple weeks ago when it's finally available worldwide. So I suppose my barometer might be a little dated in that way in terms of the travels. But in general, you know, from the passenger experience or people outside aviation, you know, we found and sort of the movie really discusses the angle that people are kind of jaded by aviation and don't really think it's advancing much and think it's kind of more of a frustrating experience than some amazing privilege or fast way to go places. And so that's sort of the overall sentiment that I've seen and continue to see in the general public in terms of their view of aviation.
Right. Almost like it's a commodity that they don't even think about. Certainly right. Not in the same way that those of us who are enthusiasts or those who are pilots or, you know, think of aviation in a really different light. And we'll get into some of that shortly when we talk about your new film for sure.
Hey, Rob, I just wanted to give you something to think about. In July, Apple said that they had $214 billion in cash sitting offshore. Their stockpile's grown a little since then, but that's one company, $214 billion.
Yeah, Apple's kind of an outlier, I think, in that regard. But it is true, Brian, that a lot of corporations that are international have sales outside the United States. have this situation. And for those listening that may not be aware of what this means, it's simply that profits that a company earns overseas are not taxable in the U.S. until those profits are brought back into the U.S. So if a company, in the case of Apple, which obviously has a lot of sales in a lot of countries, leaves those profits outside of the U.S., they're not taxed, at least not in the U.S. And in many countries where they have these accounts, they're not taxed there either. So there's a penalty to bring the money back.
And we need the cash.
Everybody needs the cash.
Yeah.
All right. An item here, and it's too bad David's not here because David would be able to explain this probably in more detail than we can. But Popular Mechanics has an article. It's titled, China Claims Its New Anti-Stealth Radars Can Detect the F-22. So for some time, I guess we know that China has been working to develop a very high frequency, or VHF, active phased array radar. Now, this kind of radar has a greater ability to detect stealth aircraft. At the Zhuhai Air Show, China showed this JY-27A 3D long-range surveillance/guidance radar, and also the broader bandwidth JY-26 Skywatcher U. Now, I'm not an expert on this, but phased array radars are, unlike the kind of the curved dish radar that we might all be familiar with, these are flat panels, and they're composed of hundreds of little small panels that transmit and receive. That's why it's called a phased array radar. They're more difficult to detect. They're less susceptible to jamming, and I guess they are better at finding stealth aircraft than conventional radar. So this is an advanced technology that China is claiming to have developed. The issue that I guess comes from this for us would be, you know, you devote all this energy, time, expense, resources in developing stealthy airplanes, but if the other guys have radar that can see your stealthy airplanes, then they're not so stealthy after all.
Oh, no. Don't tell me we've spent a whole lot of money from the taxpayers on an airplane that doesn't really do what it's supposed to do. I mean, I would be shocked, shocked to hear that.
Oh, dear. Yeah. So we'll be watching this. And when we get David back online, if not this episode in the future, I think maybe he can comment, give us a little bit more background and his perspective on that one.
Well, and you know that even without verification, that's what everybody's looking for. They're going to say to the Chinese, oh, sure, prove it to me. Show me how you can prove to me that you can really see my F. Did you say 22 or 35?
22.
22. Okay. Sorry, the 22 does work. I mean, it's the 35 that has to be
Oh, dear.
Yeah, and Max, just real fast, in other China news, Captain Yu Shu unfortunately was killed in a training accident. She was China's first female pilot.
Yeah.
Or of the J-10 fighter. So that was really unfortunate. And yeah, so I guess she ran it was a training accident, hit one of the other aircraft, and then when she ejected, she literally got hit by the other aircraft or another aircraft, and that's what killed her. Her co-pilot ejected safely, but just really sad. I mean, 30-year-old, phenomenally good pioneering pilot just unfortunately dies in a training accident.
Wow. So. Yeah, really unfortunate. All right. One last news story. This is from Dallas News. 1,300 American Airlines employees complain about hives and headaches from new uniforms, the union says. Well, American Airlines has some new uniforms. First new uniform in, I think, quite a while. But some of the flight attendants are complaining that they cause these health problems. And I guess there's some ideas as to what might be going on here, but the cause isn't known with certainty at this time. But can you imagine, you know, design the new uniforms, produce I don't know how many thousands and thousands of them, and then they seem to be containing something that causes this kind of reaction.
Yeah, and I know they've tested the fabric several times, and they keep saying that there's nothing in the fabric. I have a good friend of mine that's actually a flight attendant for American. I'm going to have to give him a call and find out if he's had any negative effects or any of his coworkers that he knows of has. But yeah, this one's definitely a mystery.
And this could be an expensive, an expensive problem to correct once they figure out what's going on here. I mean, if the uniforms are just made out of a material or include additives or I don't know what in the fabric that causes health problems, and they mm-hmm. have to dump all of these uniforms and start all over again, that's not going to be a fun solution to the problem.
No, and it's certainly making them regret. It was 30 years that they had the old uniform, so
I bet there's a
bunch of second guessing going on there.
Again, we're speaking with Brian Terwilliger. He produced and directed Living in the Age of Airplanes. Brian, again, thanks for joining us on the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Oh, great to be here.
So we've seen the film. Maybe some of our listeners have. But what is the story that The Age of Airplanes is trying to tell?
So, yeah, Living in the Age of Airplanes, it's, you know, a time we're all born into, of course. But somehow for people that don't already love aviation, like you guys and probably a lot of your listeners, if not all your listeners, the sentiment towards aviation and airplanes nowadays is really sort of it's changed a lot. You know, no longer is it as fascinating. It's much more frustrating. And that paradigm I find very ironic. Now aviation, we have more options than we've ever had, can go more places, more people have more access to the world than we've ever had before. But you contrast that to 100 years ago or, even further. But at the very advent of aviation, the fascination was extreme, all-time high, but it was incredibly impractical. It's because it was new. So there's this incredible, lack of appreciation or there's no other thing like it. There's nothing that's as good or as fast, or if we didn't fly, we probably wouldn't go. And we don't really think about it because it's never not been an option. And everyone alive today is born into the time of the airplane. But I think it's, really the most underappreciated aspect of the modern world. The internet and computers and smartphones, we're fascinated by them and appreciate them because we know very well a time before them. But this movie puts into perspective really how amazing aviation is and how it's connected things and is involved in the world we live in ways we may not even realize, even people that are within it, sort of seeing it through a new lens and a prism of sorts.
One of the examples that I find in the movie, and we don't want to tell the whole story because you don't want to give away the whole movie, but is the example of flowers, the kinds of flowers that you might purchase at a florist, and just what that path is between the grower and that flower showing up in your florist, and the vital role that aviation plays in that process. If we didn't have the ability to transport goods across continents on airplanes, you wouldn't be able to go down to the florist and buy a dozen roses for your spouse when you needed to.
Yeah, that's right. We tend to think about airplanes taking us places or people coming to see us or convening somewhere for a convention or fly-in or whatever it might be. But, of course, things go on airplanes, too. Even people have never been on an airplane. Their lives have changed or have luxuries they never would have had if it wasn't for the airplane's ability to connect things so quickly. And a flower is just a really great perishable example. And we show one in Africa. It's cut in Kenya. And prior to the airplane, and you go back just 150 years, 175 years before any sort of modern transportation or anything that's powered by an engine, that flower grown in Kenya would never leave Kenya alive. And now, in the movie, we show it ending up in a house in Alaska, and flowers still last about 2 weeks once you cut them. That's the way the world works. It's the way it works now. It's the way it worked 200 years ago. But whereas it could never leave that country alive, now it can be in Alaska and still have 10 more days to live. So it's kind of mind-bending. Again, it's harder to see this and harder to find this fascinating, but this is like truly science fiction at any other point in history, that something could be in another place and still be living in the case of something perishable, or just the fact we can go across continents and oceans within one day or before the sun sets. That's absolute crazy talk before the airplane, even 100 years ago, yeah. The things that we now do so commonplace and yet complain about, which is, of course, the greater irony. It's a time machine, you know, so people and things, and it's a connection unlike anything we've ever had.
You know, I'm curious, Brian, did you ever hear the routine that Louis C.K. does about just how amazing flying is and how – you've heard it. All right.
Oh, yeah. No. That's exactly the same
sentiment. I wonder if we got that from seeing your movie.
Yeah. No, that's been around for a while. That's, you know, really is very much – very similar in the fact of it's a perspective and, we don't tend to really see it for what it is. And he really does put it into perspective. And that's, you know, the movie puts it into context and you see how new this is. But it's hard to see something as new if it's always been that way in your own lifetime. It doesn't seem like that it's new because it's not new to us, but it's new to the world and new to humanity. And it becomes really clear when you see the timeline in the film.
So was there actually a line in the script that Harrison Ford read that said something like, "So just shut up, you bunch of whining babies"?
So was it difficult to get Harrison to narrate the film? I know we all know that, of course, that he's a great enthusiast, aviation enthusiast and pilot.
Well, yeah, he absolutely is. He loves aviation and really supports various causes for aviation. So I was fortunate that he had seen 1/6 Right, which was my first film. And I think enjoyed it very much. And we had a chance to meet at some point in the year or two after and sort of kept in touch and saw each other at different encounters in Oshkosh and a couple other events and things. And then when I had this film ready to be narrated, it was a temporary narrator at the time. And I approached him about it. And yeah, just a few days later, after connecting about it, I was showing him the film and he saw it. He totally understood it and realized, you know, the kind of story and the power of the story and how important it was and how important his role or a narrator's role would be in making it compelling and bringing these ideas truly to life. Because that's what a narrator, you know, you can't just have somebody read it, even if they're a famous celebrity voice. When it's a narrated film, it's really critical that they are giving the words meaning, not just delivering and reading the words. And so it really takes somebody that cares about what they're saying and what the story's about to do that. So he was truly the best possible person for it. And he absolutely connected with it, which was key to me. And then next thing you know, we're in a recording booth doing it.
Yeah, I think he nailed it. It's a very effective narration.
Yeah.
Now, in the movie, you visit many, many different countries. Why so many destinations in the film?
You know, the thesis of the film, really simply put, is a story about how the airplane has changed the world. And in order to do that, we wanted to show, you know, the world in the process. The movie, of course, wouldn't be possible without the airplane. So unlike, say, 1/6 Right, which was made in 1 square mile, it features and focuses specifically on a single location, the Van Nuys Airport. That's the main thesis and topic that film is about. Well, this film is really about the whole connectivity of the world and how the world was once completely separated and civilizations rose and fell without ever knowing of each other. And now we can be tourists and walking, you know, in the footsteps of people and places that we once could only read about. And we needed to show that. So it was really important to be able to go out in the real world and show in a whole variety of places the way the airplane is connecting everything and everyone.
And Brian, one of the things that I noticed with the film is again, the quantity of places that you guys went to and a lot of interior, exterior shots of airports. I thought it'd be real interesting for you to come up with a plane spotting, airplane spotting bingo type game and just see how many people could name all these different places. And I just think that'd be, that would be great fun.
We're in a lot of places. I think 11 different airports, 95 different locations total in 18 countries, and as you said, all seven continents. So yeah, it's very diverse, but it was ambitious by design, but also to be the most effective. If we tried to make this in the United States or just maybe one or two other places outside the United States, I mean, you could still tell key parts of the story, but the global feel and truly the essence of the film is heightened by the fact that it's truly shot around the world.
Brian, how is the script developed for something like this? I can imagine you start with a basic thesis for the film, an objective for the film. How did you translate that into the, you know, the actual script that was used?
Yeah, so it's, you know, a film like this, there's a lot of concepts. You know, we're not following any one thing. It's not a linear timeline or a linear story or a character arc, which inherently can help shape a story. This is really conceptual. And how do you tell a story about how the airplane has changed the world? That is a thesis. You hand that to, you know, 100 different filmmakers, you'd have 100 different versions of that story. So I basically, you know, did a lot of brainstorming and, you know, definitely had a team that we, you know, put our heads together, did a lot of research, thought of things from our own experiences, and of course, research online, and you type that question in and you get all sorts of answers and things online. But really, like, what are the different ways in which aren't so obvious, and maybe some ways that are obvious, but a way to show them that's really impactful? And again, all of this sort of adds up to the perspective as well, putting it in context to the time we're living in, the time we're born into, which is the hardest thing to see is what you already have. That's the hardest thing to appreciate is the thing you already know, the thing you already have. And so that philosophically is also really tricky. So this gets worked out through a lot of concepts and brainstorms and you know, working out these things. And then sometimes lines of narration, you know, come through that process. Other times it's just concepts that need to be shot and to see what the footage and let the story be told visually and support it with whatever necessary narration or the least amount of narration to fill in the blanks. But structurally, it was critical to figure out the flow of the beginning and middle and end of a story like this. And so a lot of that was done on paper, but honestly, the other half of it was done in post-production and the editing process, and it all sort of comes together on the end. But it's a kind of back and forth chicken and egg thing. It's not like a scripted film or a regular narrative film with actors and such, where you have an actual final script, you shoot the script, then you edit the script and you're finished. It's a very different, much more organic, progressive process of a documentary.
Now, one of the things that's striking, and I think Rob mentioned this before, is the sort of the stunning visuals. The cinematography is just really spectacular. How did you pull that off?
Well, that was always really important from day one, making it visually captivating. And, you know, we went to the IMAX format, and that's where the film was for the first 18 months of its release, just up until very recently. We premiered at the Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C., and it's been playing in many other theaters, mostly in the U.S., but also in Canada and London and a couple other countries. And so it was really important that the visuals were very big and very impactful. And so a lot of the locations we chose, obviously, that was kept in mind. And so a lot of the research was geared towards that, and where we could get shots that we hadn't seen before or shots that would truly translate into a wow moment on even the big screen or, of course, the small screen as it ultimately will happen now in TVs and small smartphones and this sort of thing. But the visuals were really important. So that was a key element all along the way for us.
Yeah, so Brian, none of this was stock footage from National Geographic?
No, it's 100% original. In fact, National Geographic wasn't brought in until the end. They were the distributor for Giant Screen and IMAX, but they were not involved in the production at all. And it's 100% original photography, except the black and white, you know, archival footage, obviously, is
sure.
Old stock footage. But right. You know, everything else, we shot it.
Yeah, it was definitely spectacular footage.
Well, you know what I thought was interesting, actually, is that when I watched it, I don't know what I expected, actually, but maybe somehow, having watched airplane movies, I expected it to be 45 minutes of airplanes.
one airplane mm-hmm. after another, and it wasn't like that. And it was such a different story from what I expected. And I'm curious, did you know roughly how long it was going to run before you started shooting, or is it something you decide after you realize you have 17 hours worth of film or something like that?
Yeah, well, actually, there's 260 hours of footage total.
Oh, my Lord.
Yeah.
Wow.
But, you know, for the format that we were making the film for IMAX or giant screen is the technical term, they need to be less than an hour because they play every hour on the hour, and to get audiences in and out, usually they're actually 40 minutes roughly, sometimes less than 40. So at 47 minutes, we're, I believe, tied for the longest film of its kind that would play in these types of IMAX venues. So yeah, we knew the time that we were backing into, and you know, you need to shoot a lot of footage and go to a lot of places and wait out weather and all sorts of things to get the kinds of shots that are in this movie. It's kind of like nature photography and animals and this sort of thing. You need to really capture a lot to get the very, very best, which is a fraction of a percent of what you actually shoot. So, that's sort of inherent in the process of making a film like this. But in terms of the, you know, airplanes and such, I mean, it's a movie about living in the age of airplanes and about, you know, the time we're in. And so it's not how airplanes work or how airplanes fly or the history of aviation. And, you know, those movies have been made. In fact, one of my very first thesis and this book, it was like a presentation book, sort of conceptually figuring out the film and presenting it when I would do pitches. And the opening page was showing all these different aviation-related documentaries that have been made, and they're usually focused on a specific person or era or aspect of aviation, type of airplane, or, you know, there's something about it that's really specific. And what was important to me with this movie, because it's been done, I feel like so many films have been done about so many topics that get into the nitty-gritty or that, you know, that tell these different stories in different ways, or the same story in a different way. And I wanted to try to find a way to tell a story I've never seen before, which is putting into context the fact that aviation exists at all, and literally like a 35,000-foot view on aviation. And I think, you know, for the audiences that have seen this, especially those, which is 99% of people that don't love airplanes and don't love aviation, for me, the trick was, how do we get people that don't already love this to see it the way we see it? And if you just show them airplanes and just show them incredible, beautiful shots of just planes, they don't care. It's not something they're into. That's not what they love. That's not what they're passionate about. You have to tell them a story, and you have to put it into perspective and have it relatable and have there be something in there for everybody. And at the end, you walk away from this, hopefully, especially as a non-aviation oriented person, but even as an aviation oriented person, you know, seeing things maybe in a new way, or realizing some of the roles the airplane has played in our lives, or some of the facts the movie presents, which you don't really think about because we don't have to think about them. But it's amazing when you do put it into perspective how it sort of changes. And so we get these emails and all sorts of things because it's been out for 18 months in theaters, and it's just, you know, puts a smile on my face when I see people say, gosh, you know, I will never think about this again. I will never complain about this aspect again. I never, you know, just never thought about these things before. You know, and if I didn't fly, I probably wouldn't go. It's a line in the movie, and it is so, so true. And so no matter how long that line is or whatever it's involved in you getting on that plane or on the other side of it, you're sitting on the tarmac for however long and whatever the delays might be, the next best way to go is so inconvenient, you probably wouldn't ever do it. And most people never do. So it's really what the key point of the film is.
And Brian, I think if David Vanderhoof were on the call with us tonight, he'd say, or he'd comment about this one bit that you brought up in the movie, which is, you know, open up the shades and look outside and just appreciate the view.
That's right. Yeah.
Right. I mean, because it truly is amazing what we get to see. And I think you've said it so well, you know, what we take for granted, and we shouldn't. It really should be appreciated.
Yeah. You know, it isn't just, I mean, you know, and it's the very surface level. It's a very fast an efficient way to go somewhere. Obviously, it's getting you there very quickly, faster than any other way. But how cool is it that on the way, you have a perspective and a view that you cannot have and do not have and never have at any other point in your life on the ground? It's only in the transportation and the travel part between two places. When, again, just for regular folks, not for pilots, obviously, but this is an opportunity that you're having. Not only are you going to New York for that meeting or wherever you're going on vacation, you have this magical time in between your departure point and your destination that has a view available to you that you do not have and cannot have at any other time or at any other point. In fact, looking out that window, you can see more in a single glance than people once saw in their entire lifetime. That's one of the lines in the film and a realization I had flying in the making of this movie. We did a lot of traveling, but with so much research and sort of the backstory about how limited and isolated people were for centuries and centuries and centuries. And now, you know, we literally are seeing more of planet Earth in a single glance than many people that lived only 20 miles from where they were born for their entire lifetime. So, yeah, really, I mean, open that shade. And I find it ironic when you're asked politely by the flight attendants to close the shade for the, you know, for everyone else to enjoy the movie. But honestly, one of the best movies you could imagine is the one out that window.
Brian, the film is available now on DVD, Blu-ray, and what, even iTunes?
Yeah, iTunes, and yeah, we're releasing it in other digital formats as we speak, and you can find all of those by just going to the website, which is airplanesmovie.com, and that will point you in all the directions that you can now see it.
Great. Fantastic. Brian, in terms of your own activities, are you flying these days? Do you have time for flying?
Ironically, actually, in the making of the film, I mean, I am a private pilot and I have my license, but during the making of the film, that took actually 6 years of my life, I wasn't able to fly just for reasons of insurance for the making of the film, Key Man Life Insurance, they call it, and there's certain restrictions. As I was a producer and director on the movie, they put these insurance policies on you to make sure that you can't do certain things. Yeah, I know. I'm not current because of that, because I went through it for so many years without doing it. And now we've been so busy on the release for home video and DVD, Blu-ray, iTunes, and et cetera, that, haven't gotten back into it yet. But, of course, it's the genesis of why I do what I do, and sure, the movies I've made have all been focused on aviation. So there's an irony there, too.
Yeah, Brian, one of the other things I just loved about the movie, or one of the scenes, I referred to it as the fireflies at the end of the movie.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, just watching the aircraft fly around, I thought that was great.
So the fireflies, yeah, that's actually one of my favorite parts as well. Because it shows aviation in a way we physically cannot see it. The human eye can't see what time-lapse photography allows us to see, which is why time-lapse is so cool. So time-lapse of airplanes at night, you don't see the airplanes, you only see the light on the airplanes. And when they're zipping around the sky at very accelerated speeds, it is incredible, the ballet of airplanes. And in, of course, certain areas around the world and approach and departures to certain airports, it's incredibly photogenic. San Francisco is the main place where most of the shots are in the film that show the fireflies, and that's exactly what a lot of people call it because it's exactly what it looks like. But it's all real photography on top of hills, different various camera positions, making a whole sequence of these beautiful, amazing, science fiction-like shots that are all real. And again, that puts it into perspective of truly what a science fiction reality we now live in that is just unthinkable and unimaginable before the airplane was around, that there'd be hundreds of people in each one of these lights just zipping around through the air from point A to B, daytime, nighttime, et cetera. So again, to visually illustrate something that is really spectacular puts, again, hopefully a new appreciation in the audience of, you know what, this really is like science fiction when the thing I complain about is actually unbelievable. And that is truly, hopefully, one of the big takeaways. And visually, that really helps do it.
Yeah, definitely love that part.
Did you come up with that idea to do time-lapse photography at night, showing the planes flying around looking like fireflies?
Actually, I saw something online, you know, many years ago when I was doing research for the film. And it was in a demo reel of somebody's work, and I saw a shot that had just a glimpse of this in it, and there were planes, you know, in the background flying. And it totally captivated me. And actually I reached out to that person and, we got to meet and asked him how they did what they did. And they said, oh, I actually had some more of that. And I saw it, ended up hiring them, and all the shots that you see, actually all the time-lapse photography in the whole film is, that guy. His name is Ben Wiggins, and he's, you know, amazing. And the actual photography that's all time-lapse is his, in the film.
Yeah. It's definitely beautiful. Do you see something in the future for Brian Terwilliger, another film perhaps?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course. You know, I love aviation. I love bringing stories and documentaries, you know, to life and sharing my passion through that medium. So, yeah, there's some other ideas I have and some new opportunities that are sort of coming my way now that the movie is out and people are seeing it. So a lot to consider. I haven't committed to anything quite yet, but you know, we're getting through this part of the release through the holidays into early next year before I transition to anything else. But yeah, there's more to come for sure.
Good. Fantastic. So Living in the Age of Airplanes, the website is airplanesmovie.com. Brian Terwilliger, thank you so much.
Great. Thanks, guys, so much.
All right, well, besides losing David Vanderhoof to Skype, we've lost Max Trescott as well. So, guys, it's just the three of us to carry on. A couple of mentions. Just wanted to tell folks that the PaxX podcast, episode 40, is out with Mary Kirby and Chris Keljard. He's an aviation and travel industry reporter. An editor. He's been writing for over three decades. One of the topics that we talk about is, will Trump affect travel and tourism in the U.S.? There's interesting thoughts on that. We also talk about CFMI's LEAP engine and the new Colombian airline Wingo. So you can find that at paxexpodcast.com. That's P-A-X-E-X podcast.com. Up next, we have a very interesting recording. One of our listeners, a Marine, submitted a story to us, and it's such a great story, and I guess he didn't want to record it himself, so we pressed Micah into service to read this story. Micah added, of course, his own a little bit of magic to it as well. So
again, we've put Micah in front of the mic.
Micah in front of the mic. Yes.
Okay, sorry.
This is called Favorite Aircraft by a Marine. And let's listen to Micah.
So with this being the Monday after Veterans Day in the USA, Remembrance Day in the UK and Commonwealth countries, and with an email coming in to us from an anonymous US Marine that I'll get to in a minute, I thought I'd tell you a bit about a couple of Marines I grew up with. My mother, Harriet, had two sisters, one 4 years older and one 7 years younger. Both of them married Marines. Unfortunately, these were the only two Marines I ever got to know very well. Some of you may have heard me talk a little bit about my Uncle Ralph. He was too young to join the Marines during the war, and by that I mean World War II. But he served post-war in the Mediterranean, on board the aircraft carriers USS Carl C. and Franklin D. Roosevelt. Ralph truly enjoyed his time in the Corps and would talk about it all the time. My Uncle Irving, well, he lied to join the U.S. Marine Corps just after Pearl Harbor. He was just 16 years old, although his Marine papers showed him as 17. Even at the false age of 17, he had to have his mother sign forms that allowed him to enlist. It was easy for him to get her signature, though. You see, his mother didn't read any English, and Uncle Irving told her they were school papers. After Paris Island, Irving took part in the Guadalcanal campaign, the Battle of Guam, and his last campaign, Bougainville. You see, on Bougainville, he was shot by a sniper. That shot knocked him unconscious and paralyzed his right arm. He woke up on a beachhead surrounded by wounded and dying men, and although paralyzed, screamed for a weapon. He wanted to get back to his squad and do his job. It was then he was given a shot of morphine, The next thing he remembered was being on a hospital ship. It turned out that none of Uncle Irving's squad came back from Bougainville. That's all I know about Uncle Irving's service, and I only got it second or third hand. You see, Uncle Irving didn't talk much about his time in the Corps. As I said earlier, recently we received an anonymous email from a Marine. Bear in mind I didn't say former Marine, because as the saying goes, once a Marine, always a Marine. So at the request of this anonymous Marine and for my Uncle Irving, I'd like to read you both his email and his story. Here's the email. The Airplane Geeks podcast some time ago had a favorite airplane survey. My entry is late, and it was emotionally difficult to write, but afforded me an opportunity to reflect on my military service. Maybe Micah could read it for me, as I've got a face made for radio and a voice made for silent films, and I've always enjoyed hearing his stories of his experiences with aviation. I'm not sure I could get through a listener recording on my own. I would like to remain anonymous, please, but wanted to share my experience of aviation with others who may be looking for direction. If you choose not to air it, that's perfectly fine. I would like to at least thank you for keeping my aviation dreams alive and well every week. Sincerely, Marine. Well, thank you, Marine. We wouldn't think not to air it, and it's a great honor to be able to read your story for you. Here it is. My wife, my two young daughters, and I went to Beaufort, South Carolina, to attend a wedding. While we were there, we took one day and went to the air show at the Marine Corps Air Station. While making our way around the static displays, I started to hear the familiar whoop, whoop, whoop behind me and to my left, and there I saw it, the UH-1 Iroquois, or UWI, being operated by a Vietnam-era aviation organization. The volunteers were all dressed in the army drab field uniforms of the era. I started to get a bit choked up, and tears started to well in my eyes. It brought me back. It brought me back to Afghanistan, where that bittersweet sound of Blackhawks coming in meant that our dying brothers, at least, had some sort of chance against the odds. But it was a game they never won. It brought me back to the heat and the blowing sand and dirt in your face, as I did a quick stop and descended to pick up the dying. It brought me back to having to later go back to my Marines and tell them that yet another one of their brothers had passed away, and praying for their families. It reminded me of waiting at the landing zone, praying and straining to hear the rotor blades to indicate help was near, as seconds felt like hours. It brought me back. It brought me back. That whoop, whoop, whoop of the rotors reminded me of much of the uncertainty a young man being sent to Vietnam faced and the huge role the UWI had. Uncertainty of enemy contact upon landing in an LZ. Uncertainty of life and death. The only unwavering certainty was that those other faces in the helicopter were in it with you, and all would do their best to ensure that they looked after each other. I remembered seeing the look amongst my Marines as our company left our base for the last time to assault a possible enemy position. Confident in their training and abilities, confident in their brothers, uncertain of their fate. It brought me back to the bold pilots who braved hot landing zones to evacuate wounded in Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan. I wondered if young infantrymen in Vietnam had the same visceral response to the sound of incoming helicopters as young infantrymen in Afghanistan and Iraq. It brought me back to my father's time in the service during Vietnam. He worked in the intelligence field in the Army, and has yet to speak of it much outside of minor anecdotes. But 35 years after his Vietnam service, he visited the Vietnam Memorial. I think we all gave him his space, and his only remarks about the visit were to my mother, when he said, "It was good that he went." For a man, a few emotional words, it spoke volumes to me. My wife saw me staring and noted that it sure was a beautiful aircraft, and it had a very distinctive sound. I replied, "Yes, it sure does." I can't imagine what it was like to be an 18-year-old young man in Vietnam, riding in a UWI, into an unknown area, or waiting to hear that sound to get out. My wife, also a service member, understood what I meant, and we both stood there watching in a moment of silence together. My wife's father was a Marine in Vietnam, and was injured in combat and sent home. I wondered what response my father-in-law would have to that distinctive sound. As the helicopter lifted off and climbed above the treetops, that beautiful sight and sound reminded me of why I got into aviation in the first place. After back-to-back combat tours in Iraq and then Afghanistan, I received orders and was moved to a new billet in a training command. I was behind a desk a lot, organizing, training, making phone calls, going to meetings, and I didn't have any Marines. Some might call it a break, Some might call it culture shock. Either way, I needed something to fill a gap. I was living alone at the time, as my wife was in college several states away. I'm not sure what prompted me or how I came to it, but I scheduled an intro flight with a local instructor who had an Aranca L3, a J3 Cub lookalike. I remember the morning vividly. It was cool, there was dew on the grass, and I was excited, as I had learned about the sport pilot license recently. We taxied down to the end of the grass strip, turned around, and pushed the throttles forward. The tail lifted up shortly during our takeoff roll, and we danced on the rudder pedals to keep the bird away from the trees on either side of the runway. Shortly thereafter, the 65-horsepower engine was pulling us up into the air. It was absolutely breathtaking. I was free. I was above the madness of what remained on the ground. Nothing else mattered except this wonderful, freeing, and enlightening experience. I was in control of it. It was beautiful, and I could see the trees, cars, and houses beneath me. I could smell the forest through the open window. I felt as if the airplane were my personal wings. We landed after what seemed like 5 minutes, but in all actuality, we had been flying for half an hour. I had been having so much fun I'd completely lost track of any sense of time. It was amazing. I scheduled a follow-on flight the next day and steadily worked toward my sport pilot's license, then switched over to a private pilot license. Not too long after, I seriously began flight training. The night sweat stopped, caused by dreams I'm glad I didn't remember when I woke up. Aviation was my release. I remember taking my mom, dad, and younger brother each on a flight when they came to visit that Christmas after I got my pilot's license. They were my first passengers. And I remember seeing the similar reaction in their faces as they gained an excitement for travel in that third dimension. I hope to share that same excitement with my daughters as they grow up, before they find out how lame Dad really is. From the time I heard the sound and turned my head to look at the UE to when it lifted off over the trees was probably over in a matter of 4 minutes. But the sound and sight of that olive-drab UE brought back a flood of memories and experiences relating both me and my father's generation of veterans and a hope for my future in aviation. And for that, it will always be my favorite aircraft. Semper Fidelis. Thank you from all of us for your story, Marine. And more importantly, thank you for your service. And from me, thank you for bringing back some memories of the Marines in my life and for letting me share them. For the airplane geeks here in Portland, Maine, and for this anonymous Marine listener, this is your main man, Micah.
Holy smokes. That was incredible. I don't know who that
Wow.
I don't know who that Marine was, but let me tell you, buddy, or lady, because it might be a lady. Incredible. Wow. I wonder if you've got any more stories that you might want to tell us, because, boy, I'd like to listen.
Yes, I agree with that completely. And we want to thank Micah for taking the time to put that together and record it for us. Thanks, Micah.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, I know. It almost leaves you speechless. The first time I listened to it, lots of memories flooded into my head about people that I knew who were fighters in the Vietnam War or just other conflicts in general. Mm-hmm. And it's just easy to relate to a lot of aspects of that story. So really, really good. All right, next up, Brian, you have some kind of interesting news for us concerning our friend John Mollison.
Yeah, our Airplane Geeks art historian. I've just given him that title, I think, because I just love his work. And he's made a story that he wrote available for free. It's quite a few pages in length, but it's a great story about Colonel Hank Snow and just being a fighter pilot, fought in three wars, survived 666 missions. And it's his story. And I just found it really fascinating. And the fact that John made this available for free for Veterans Day, I just wanted to spread the word and encourage everyone to go out and download the story and read about this really fascinating, incredible individual.
So we can put this link in the show notes to the story?
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. This is called 666, the Devil's Number. Of course, that comes from the 666, the 666 combat missions. The amazing service of Colonel Hank Snow. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes. It is large. It's about 90 meg or something. It's a PDF that you can download, and it's got a lot of really fantastic photographs, a lot of historical documentation. It's really a nice piece of work.
Yep, really is.
And, of course, you can see John's show, Old Guys and Their Airplanes, at oldguysandtheirairplanes.com. Be sure to check that out if you haven't already. Up next, let's see. Did you do this, too, on Mary Lyons?
Yeah.
Okay. Brian, what else have you got for us?
Gee, I wasn't expecting that. So the woman that I met over in Farnborough, Mary B. Lyons, published the book Fabulous Farnborough Air Show and Photographs. And she's updated the book to include 2016, all the aircraft that she shot then. And she also has made the book available to U.S. folks, and it includes postage to the U.S., so it's really easy for us to get. Yeah, she is based in the UK, and doing money conversion and shipping was a problem. So she went ahead and took care of all those problems in her new website. And I just thought, if people were interested in the aircraft, and especially a historical look at the aircraft, because she goes from 1998 through 2016, covering the air show. So just some fantastic shots. And she was just such a lovely woman to meet, and really had a good time with her and her husband. And yeah, just thought I'd give a plug for the book.
And where can we go to find this book?
It's at wordpowerbookstore.com, then /gallery-1.html. It'll be in the show notes.
It'll be in the show notes. And how much does this book cost?
It's $35. That includes postage to the U.S. So for a picture book that has some pretty fantastic photographs, it's an excellent deal.
Wow. Yeah, that is. And that includes postage?
Yep, includes postage from the U.K.
Wow. Outstanding. All right. Thanks, Brian. Moving on to some listener mail that we heard from Patrick. He sent us a link to an article and notes that in Australia, they've got a problem. There have been multiple fake tower calls at some different Australian airports, and these have caused some emergency go-arounds, events like that. We'll put a link to this in the show notes, but apparently police, they've launched an investigation. Pilots on approach to Melbourne have received these fake air traffic control communications. I'm not sure what to make of this. This has got to be a serious, serious matter.
Yeah, that's super serious and criminal, and I can't wait for them to find the person that's doing this, because that's just not good. And I'm sure Rob could talk about doing an emergency go-around when you're, 200 feet off the deck. That's just not a good place to be.
No, go around at any altitude. It's always a challenge, to be honest. But I mean, the fact that they've got somebody out there that thinks this is funny, this is worse than one of these idiots pointing the lasers at airplanes.
The article that Patrick sent to us notes that the authorities believe that whoever is doing this is using a portable transmitter. It says from a nearby airport car park. I wonder if this is just, some idiot that's doing this, or if this is some sort of, pretest for something even more sinister. I hope it's not that.
Oh, never even thought about that.
This is not exactly a new concept. I mean, there have been portable two-way, aircraft band transceivers out there for 30 or 40 years. So And this kind of thing has popped up here in the U.S. every once in a while, but not very often. But I would think, too, though, that of course, I was going to say they could try and triangulate the signal. But when you have a transmission that runs for maybe 2 seconds, that doesn't give anybody much of a chance to find anybody.
Rob, having been an air traffic controller, let me ask you this. If somebody was doing this, would they necessarily need some kind of controller experience to be able to pull this off in a believable way, or would it be not too difficult, do you think?
I don't think it would be too difficult once you learn the lingo, and you just have to make your voice sound like you mean it. And when controllers, you know, issue a pilot a go around, it's not, you know, American 353 go around, please. You know, I mean,
yeah,
I mean, they're saying it because there's something that crew needs to know about that's in the way, and they want them to know right now. And but again, if you can duplicate that, boy, that's a toughie. But then too, you know that whoever's doing it has some sort of a view of the final approach from somewhere in order to know when to do these and when to issue these go around instructions. So, again, that's not going to be an easy one to find, though, if this keeps going on.
Yeah, and Rob, it's not even like the pilot has any time to question the controller, because oftentimes the controllers change before the aircraft lands. So you're used to hearing multiple voices, right? So if a new voice comes on, it's completely believable. And you're not going to say, wait, that doesn't sound right. Or, yeah, I don't see anything on the runway. I'm going to land anyway. I mean, you just start the go around and geez.
Absolutely. Because when controllers are being trained, they're actually working the live traffic, and you never, if they're any good, you never hear the voice of the instructor in the background. And the instructor has a way that they can override the transmission of the student in case, you know, the student says, oh, you know, clear to land. And the instructor goes, oh, yeah, but I don't think so. And they send somebody around. It would be that different voice. But again, that's the backup. But again, so I agree with you, Brian. Nobody would even notice the difference. And no one would ever take the risk. They just said, we'll go around and we'll figure it out later.
Yeah, and I could just imagine there are a lot of planes coming into Melbourne from the U.S., for example. They don't have much fuel left when they're landing. Right. So I certainly they have the reserves, but I'd imagine that they're close at that point.
You know, that's an interesting question. I don't know how that would work out. But of course, it also depends on where in the sequence they're giving them the go around. And but again, if it keeps happening in the same place, eventually it becomes even more dangerous, because then if the pilots learn that there's somebody on the ground screwing around, how are they going to determine when it's somebody screwing around or somebody that really says, no, you really need to do this?
Yeah, exactly.
Hmm. All right. Well, I hope they're able to locate the individual or individuals who are doing this. We'll watch for further developments. And if any of you listening run across something before we do, please let us know. One other listener mail, a little bit of feedback from Mark. He wrote us and said, well, you asked for aviation jokes. So he sent us a joke. So here it is. So there was a tanker aircraft and a fighter in formation on a long mission. The fighter pilot calls up the tanker and says, quote, I'm bored and we still have another 3 hours to go. Look at this. He rolls around the tanker, loops right around him. Then hanging inverted over the tanker's cockpit, he waves at the pilot and says, bet you can't do that. As he pulls back into formation, the tanker pilot says, that's nothing. Look at this. For 5 minutes, the planes fly on straight and level. The fighter pilot calls up, says, well, what are you going to do? The tanker pilot says, I've done it. Got up, walked back, had a pee, got a coffee, and got a donut. I bet you can't do that. Thanks, Mark.
Smartly done.
Very nicely done. All right. Mark's from the UK. We want to thank Mark for writing in. The UK is one of our big sort of regional areas outside of the U.S. We do have some statistics from that. We'll be presenting some of those really shortly from our listener survey, so look forward to that. But the UK is, we have a lot of listeners in the UK. All right. Well, I think that's going to do it for this episode. We want to thank you all for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Our guest was Brian Terwilliger. He produced and directed Living in the Age of Airplanes. And you can learn more about that at the website. It's airplanesmovie.com. As always, you can find us on airplanegeeks.com. Show notes at airplanegeeks.com/427. You'll find lots of links there to the stories we mention, how to contact us, how to find us on social media and so forth. But let's tell folks where they can find those of us who are remaining online. Rob Mark, we'll start with you.
Well, I'm glad I'm still here. Thank you, Microsoft and Skype. They can find me at Flying Magazine at the newsstands. They can find us at flyingmag.com or any place that has Jetwine in the title.
Great. And Brian Coleman, how do folks reach you?
Oh, the best place to get a hold of me is at brian@airplanegeeks.com. Also wanted to, I guess, ask a question. We're going to leave the survey up for one more week. This will be the last week, or is the survey closed?
We'll leave it open for another week. So if you haven't taken advantage of an opportunity to give us some feedback, just visit airplanegeeks.com/survey. It's only 5 minutes. It's very quick. And we'd appreciate getting some feedback and some information from you.
Yeah, and I wanted to remind the listeners also that while they're on the website, if they could click on the donate button, they could help keep the show advertising free and help support our habit of traveling around and making field reports and just doing the show.
All right. We never even had David Vanderhoof on, but you'll want to check out his blog at whatjustflewby.com. Along the way, we lost Max Trescott. You can find him at, I guess the best place is g1000book.com. You can find me on Twitter, Max Flight. Look for me on LinkedIn with David every Friday at theuavdigest.com. Also with Mary Kirby on the PAXX podcast. Our outro music is by Bruno Massone. You can find more of his compositions that incorporate aviation sounds at his website, brunomassone.com. So please join us next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.